America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I believe that probably the biggest story of the year is breaking right now. The 18.5-minute gap revisited, and we will get to that in just a minute. Although, before I do, I just wanted to note that overnight, Kurt Vonnegut passed away at the age of 84. In 2003, Kurt Vonnegut, author of Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's, which, by the way, detailed his... He was a prisoner of war during World War II outside of Dresden. I forget the name of the prisoner of war camp he was in. And he was then, you know, after at the end of the war, he came out into Dresden and just saw the horror that was inflicted on that city by the firebombing, you know, just virtually destroyed the city. And years later, nearly three decades later, wrote Slaughterhouse-Five. Inspired by that, he wrote God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater and Cat's Cradle and so many other brilliant books. In 2003, in an interview with In These Times, he said, "I myself feel that our country, for whose constitution I fought in a just war, might as well have been invaded by Martians and body snatchers." He's speaking to the Bush administration. He says, "Sometimes I wish it had been. What has happened, though, is that it's been taken over by means of the sleaziest, low-comedy, Keystone Cop-style coup d'etat imaginable. And those now in charge of the federal government are upper-crust C students who know no history or geography, plus not-so-closeted white supremacists, a.k.a. Christians, end quotes, and plus, more frighteningly, psychopathic personalities, or PPs, rather than ETs." Kurt Vonnegut. It's good having you here on the planet while you were here with us. Okay, here's the story that is... I believe that this has the potential. 33 years ago, this month, in fact, 33 years ago, yesterday, the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives subpoenaed from Richard Nixon tapes, Watergate tapes, and Richard Nixon, and we're seeing the exact same thing being played out right now with regard to emails from the White House once more. And Richard Nixon came before the committee, or came actually addressed the United States. He went on TV and he made an address to talk about the fact that the Judiciary Committee. Well, here is Richard Nixon.
"I have asked for this time tonight in order to announce my answer to the House Judiciary Committee subpoena for additional Watergate tapes, and to tell you something about the actions I shall be taking tomorrow, about what I hope they will mean to you, and about the very difficult choices that were presented to me. These actions will at last, once and for all, show that what I knew and what I did with regard to the Watergate break-in and cover-up were just as I have described them to you from the very beginning."
In other words, Nixon came forward and said, "I am not a crook, and I'm going to release the tapes and prove it." In fact, he goes on to talk about how there had been all these... Now, see, this is the one distinction here is that nobody in the press so far, at least that I've noticed, has been connecting George W. Bush to this ongoing scandal. It goes as high as Karl Rove. I'm waiting for Bush to get into this, and it's just frankly, I think it's just a matter of time. Nixon went on to say that...
"For more than a year, there have been allegations and insinuations that I knew about the planning of the Watergate break-in, and that I was involved in an extensive plot to cover it up. The House Judiciary Committee is now investigating these charges."
Yeah, deja vu all over again. And then he refers to 33 years ago yesterday.
"On April 11th, the Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena for 42 additional tapes of conversations, which it contended were necessary for its investigation. I agreed to respond to that subpoena by tomorrow. In these folders that you see over here on my left are more than 1,200 pages of transcripts of private conversations I participated in."
And he continues, and is this starting to feel like deja vu? This was the first document dump. I mean, this was Nixon coming out and say, okay, you know, we'll do the document dump. And then the House Judiciary Committee, see, this was in, already they had gotten some Watergate tapes. This was the second pass. This is exactly what's happening now. Now the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary, actually now it's Pat Leahy in the Senate, saying, excuse me, Mr. Bush. Now they refer to it euphemistically as the White House. We don't have those tapes yet. We don't have those copies of the emails yet. And it turns out that the White House has been, apparently right from the very beginning, using AOL accounts and a variety of Republican National Committee accounts to allow folks within the White House to engage in what may well be highly illegal activities without there being any paper trail. And when I say highly illegal, I mean, this is not, you know, oh, gee, I think I'll just, you know, blow this out. I mean, Karl Rove, Jack Abramoff had sent an email to an assistant of Karl Rove by accident. And we have this because it showed up in the official email dumps coming out of the White House that said, damn it, it's not supposed to go on the White House system. Right. In other words, he sent an email. You know, this is the guy who's gone to jail for his activity. He sent an email saying, "Oops, this is not supposed to be subpoenaable. This is not supposed to be something that people can see. This is not something, you know, that is available to people. This was not. This is not some. You know, they're trying to say, oh, this is for the Hatch Act." This is so if we're engaged in business that it's not the government's business, we're not doing it on government computers. Because the Hatch Act says that in the offices of Congress, members of Congress can't engage in business that's not related to governance, that they can't do fundraising, for example, from their offices, that they can't do campaigning from their offices. They have to do that outside their offices. So the White House says, oh, yeah, well, we're doing this to comply with the Hatch Act. No, they're doing it to avoid a redux of the Nixon administration. In fact, Nixon went on to say,
in these transcripts, portions not relevant to my knowledge or actions with regard to Watergate are not included.
And once again, we've seen blocked out, redacted, so-called redacted parts of these so-called emails. And again, the senator from Vermont, Senator Leahy, is saying, no, not going to go there, not going to go there. And then Nixon again was saying, hey, we've given you everything. We've given you everything.
As far as what the president personally knew and did with regard to Watergate and the cover-up is concerned, these materials, together with those already made available, will tell it all.
In fact, he even said, hey, you know, I'll meet privately with Congress and I'll talk to you behind closed doors, not under oath, and tell you whatever you want to know. Does this sound familiar?
I shall invite Chairman Rodino and the committee ranking minority member, Congressman Hutchinson of Michigan, to come to the White House and listen to the actual full tapes of these conversations so that they can determine for themselves beyond question that the transcripts are accurate and that everything on the tapes relevant to my knowledge and my actions on Watergate is included.
Doesn't that sound incredibly sincere? Doesn't that just sound so sincere? Yes, I'm giving you everything. I mean, we've done this document dump. We've released a whole bunch of tapes, and I'm telling you, I don't know anything about this Watergate thing. I have no idea what's going on here. And in fact, I'll even invite the chairman of the House Committee and the chairman of the Senate Committee to come to the White House, and I'll sit down with them and I'll talk with them, and it'll be. Not under oath, of course, and it'll be off the record, of course, but I'll talk with them and I'll tell them whatever they want. This is deja vu all over again.
If there should be any disagreement over whether omitted material is relevant, I shall meet with them personally in an effort to settle the matter. I believe this arrangement is fair, and I think it's appropriate.
Yes, it's fair and appropriate. Where have we recently heard those terms? I mean, this is 33 years ago yesterday. This is actually from an address on April 29th, 1974 that I'm sharing with you from Nixon. But it was 33 years ago yesterday that the House Judiciary Committee subpoenaed the second set of documents, that it took Nixon 3 weeks to say, okay, I'll give them to you, and that, and thus this speech. Will this be what brings down the Bush administration and finally leads to the impeachment of Bush and Cheney? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Streaming the truth 24 hours a day. This is AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now tell me the truth, is anything so uncouth? Could a person be more of a mess than to chatter and such and say stay in touch, but don't have an email address?
Yes, Lord.
Now God clearly meant that an email be sent anytime that you have a thought. And if your inbox ain't scoured 5 or 6 times an hour, then you ain't doing all that you ought. How could I ever stay in touch without my ISP?
Well, this is the problem, you see, that the Bush and Robies had, that clearly Carl wrote. 50 people in the White House, currently somewhere in the low 20s, apparently. This is assuming that we're to actually believe what the White House says. 50 people historically, you know, over the course of the last few years, and 20 some odd people right now, are using these back channel Republican National Committee email accounts, apparently in order to avoid oversight that was provided for in 1978 by law in the Presidential Records Act that was passed as a result of Richard Nixon saying things like, and by the way, if you heard Bush's speech the other day or his press conference where he said, well, the reason why we can't release all these emails is because the president's got to be able to get good advice, you know? And here's Richard Nixon from 33 years ago this month.
Ever since the existence of the White House taping system was first made known last summer, I have tried vigorously to guard the privacy of the tapes.
Yeah, just like the White House email system, right? You got to keep private. Why?
But the problem I confronted was this. Unless a president can protect the privacy of the advice he gets, he cannot get the advice he needs.
Now, where have you heard that before? I mean, this is pretty mind-boggling. Pretty mind-boggling. Nixon, by the way, ultimately, you know, where he ended up as a consequence of this was giving a speech, what would this be, about 5 months later? Now, consider the timeline. This, the subpoena from the House Judiciary Committee came 33 years ago yesterday. And yesterday, or the day before yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee subpoenaed this White House, which is defending itself on basically the exact same basis. So this is April. And on April 29th, Nixon gave in and said, okay, here, you can have all the tapes. And they found the so-called smoking gun tape, in which Nixon is sitting there conspiring with Haldeman and Ehrlichman and to cover up the White House Watergate, or the Watergate burglary. And so fast forward to August 8th. So it started on April 11th with the subpoena, and now August 8th. So that's April, May, June, July, August, 5 months later. Just 3 days short of 5 months later, Richard Nixon once again requests the networks to give him national television time, sits down in the White House in the Oval Office, looks into the camera, and says to the American people,
"In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me."
This is called putting lipstick on a pig, but...
"In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort."
Do you get that? He no longer has a strong enough political base in the Congress. It's because the Republicans were deserting him 100%. Once these tapes came out and were listened to, 100% of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee said, that's it, we will vote for impeachment of this guy.
As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion. That to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process, and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged.
You get it? It's all about the political base. How many Republicans are going to desert Bush before he says...
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
All as a result of losing his political base, although he was very glad to have served us.
I shall leave this office with regret at not completing my term, but with gratitude for the privilege of serving as your president for the past 5.5 years.
It's that half a year that gets you, because we're, what, 6.5 years now? So, we are seeing right now the exact same scenario being played out with regard to the White House, the Bush White House, as happened 33 years ago this month. Yesterday, with regard to the Nixon White House. Sir, we would like copies of that, of those communications. We would like to know what was going on inside the White House. Yes, executive privilege should, and we will respect it protecting you if you're discussing, for example, national security matters with your national security advisor. But executive privilege does not protect criminal conduct in the White House. And we already have Jack Abramoff on record on the White House servers saying, oops, I should have sent this to the RNC. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
So the story, pretty straightforward. This is from Reuters. Some White House staff wrote email messages about official business on Republican Party accounts, and some may have been wrongly deleted. Gee, wrongly deleted. Sort of like Rosemary Woods in the 18.5-minute gap in the tapes of Nixon's, where she had to have her foot over on one side of the room and her hand over on the other side of the room to accidentally hold down the button. Yeah. The White House said it could not rule out the possibility that some official emails related to the firing of attorneys had been deleted and are lost. In other words, this White House may actually succeed in having a successful cover-up, whereas the Nixon White House failed. They missed one tape. That's all it took. And the lesson was not lost on the Republican Party. The Republican Party still operating under a restraining order for their caging, their electoral antics against African Americans, even though they violated that caging order both in 2004 in Ohio and in 2000 in Florida. When you have a political party that's operating under court orders, under restraining orders, you have to ask yourself, you know, what's up with this? And a law passed specifically in 1978 to stop this kind of Republican misbehavior. And again, you have to take it back to the key to the whole thing. The key to the whole thing is that if you don't believe in governing, if you don't believe that government is a good thing, if you believe that government is a bad, nasty thing, and you believe essentially in the idea of kingdom, that, you know, whatever the king does is fine. It's, you know, it's, if the king does it, then of course it's the way it's supposed to be, right?
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Nixon. And so, you know, if you believe that, then the president can do anything he wants. And why have democracy? Pat Leahy is not buying this, this message from the Bush administration. He says, this sounds like the administration's version of the dog ate my homework. Mike in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Mike. Oh. I have a feeling George Bush can't say the same right now.
No, but unfortunately, he should have been saying that same thing about, I don't know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Well, he should have been doing better.
Yes, well, it's just tragic. I was thinking about it while I was waiting, and you know, we can only hope that this whole attorney gate thing will be what brings down his administration. Of course, it should have happened. I mean, arguably his administration should have never happened after being installed by the Supreme Court. However, he should have been impeached a long time ago, and I think the only reason why it hasn't happened is really because of the conglomeration of media and the removal of the fairness doctrine in media. You know, even if there was a Republican-controlled Congress, which there was for the first six years of his administration, if there had been both sides of the story getting out on a consistent basis, I think public pressure would have brought him down sooner. It would have forced the Congress to act on the myriad of law-breaking that his administration has done.
Yeah, I would say what we no longer have, thank you, Mike, we no longer have programming in the public good in the United States. And when the news departments are of major networks are put under the purview of the entertainment departments, then you know something wrong is happening. You know, it's just not in the context of democracy in America, the future of democracy. If the press in this country really and truly is the fourth estate, if it really is essentially the fourth branch of government for all practical purposes, whose job is to keep everybody honest in government. And clearly the founders and framers thought that they subsidized the cost of newsprint so that newspapers could be, even if they weren't profitable, that they could continue to publish. They literally, for the first 50 years of this republic, we subsidized the cost of newsprint. And from the founding of this republic until this day, we subsidize the delivery of newspapers. Newspapers can be delivered by fourth-rate mail, a rate specifically and unique to newspapers and periodicals, which is hyper-cheap. I mean, the post office loses huge bucks delivering newspapers at the fourth-class rate. But it was a subsidy because the founders and framers acknowledged how important the press was to be an independent instrument. And now what is it? Infotainment. As a result of Reagan's suspending the enforcement of the Sherman Act in 82, and for all practical purposes, leading to the mergers and acquisition mania, and is ending the fairness doctrine in 87. And as I've said before, I'm quite ambivalent about the fairness doctrine, but I think that the idea of programming the public good, and also the idea of investigative journalism. I mean, we talked yesterday about cultural consensus. Let's have a cultural consensus that investigative journalism is a good thing, and that we honor people like Greg Palast rather than, you know, making it so that they've got a report for the BBC, because no network in the United States will run their reporting, because it might upset the administration, and then our blow-dried anchorman would lose access to the White House. Steve in Georgia. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom, coming at you live from the great red state of Georgia.
Yeah, where I lived for 13 years.
Yep. I have a question for you, but first I want to point out the hypocrisy here. Remember when we were discussing wiretapping, how the Republicans always say, hey, you know, what do you have to worry about if you don't have anything to hide?
Right, exactly. And this the parallel is absolutely perfect here. Did the RNC do this? Why were these guys given special Blackberries and special PCs with special White House or not White House with special Republican Party GWB George W. Bush GWB 43
right.
whatever .com or .org accounts for email when in fact if you're doing non-government business, you're not even supposed to be in the building.
And so what they're going to say, of course, is that it was, you know, there's probably security reasons in there. So could you discuss like what the proper course of action would be for a White House if they had to discuss sensitive information?
Yeah, well, the White House email system is a secure email system. AOL is not. I mean, you know, GWB.org is not. So there's actually that even further indicts them. If they're talking government business over non-secure email systems, that's crazy. I mean, that's right. And they cannot claim that as justification. And now We have, and Steve, thanks for the call. Good point. We have, first of all, Dana Perino back on March 27th. This is what, a week and a half ago? Saying, oh yeah, no problem. The RNC has been archiving all our emails. So, you know, if Henry Waxman wants copies of these emails with Karl Rove, we don't know yet if George W. Bush has an RNC email account or if he uses email, but, you know, if he wants copies of Karl Rove's emails, no problem. We can provide that. She said, this has been something that has been in place long before that, that being Waxman's request for the emails, that they be preserved. She added, the archiving that would have been for any of these over the past few years of emails that has been going back and forth between people who would have had these accounts to the outside. Excuse me. And she now is correcting the statement. The news state, this is yesterday. Yesterday, the White House said, you know, the White House hasn't done a good enough job overseeing staff using political email accounts to assure compliance with the Presidential Records Act. This was Scott Stansel, White House spokesman, in an unusual late afternoon teleconference, a teleconference with reporters. And talking with Victoria Jones earlier today, some rather high-profile reporters were left out of that teleconference, by the way. And also the White House acknowledged yesterday, this is from thinkprogress.org, by the way, that far more than a handful of staffers use the political email accounts, 22 right now, but over 50 have them. So it's pretty bizarre. It's pretty bizarre. Bill in San Diego, California. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how's it going? I'm an attorney down here in San Diego, and I've been watching the Carol Lamb appointment, her career, her prosecution, who she prosecuted, and then her firing. And I'm kind of in the hotbed of the right-wing machine down here. And I'm old enough to have been around in the days of Watergate and watched what happened with Ellsberg and how he went to war in Vietnam and the parallel here with Bush and the Downing Street memo and the Wilson Plame affair. You know, you just follow the money.
Yeah.
And I think what they did with the Nixon, the Ford pardon, was to save the base. And I think we really need to look at impeaching the base and see who these
were. No, what Ford did was establish a terrible precedent. But was that your point, Bill?
Yeah, that's basically my point, that the these back-channel communications here are designed to both get around the Hatch Act and the Presidential Papers Act.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, and the Presidential Records Act. Spot on, Bill. Well said. And in fact, they're claiming that they're doing it to be in compliance with the Hatch Act. They're saying, well, we've got to do this because the Hatch Act says that we can't do business, using government property. So we'll do it using government property, the desks and offices, but we'll use our RNC email accounts and our RNC computers. And I'm sorry, it just doesn't cut it for me. I am waiting to hear, the plangent tones of Mr. Bush saying something like,
to have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American.
Yeah. Kind of a sad note, wasn't it? A president on his way out. He's not a crook. Definitely not a crook, but he's on his way out. Could it happen again? I think it's possible if enough people get active and get mobilized and say to their members of Congress, we would like these guys, we would like these bums thrown out. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Scott in Richmond, Virginia. You're live on the air, Scott.
How you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's up?
I can't imagine that in the next couple of weeks that this does not trump everything that's come before it. The fact that they, from the outset of the administration, went out of their way to bypass the laws that they agreed to enforce and live by.
Yeah, we just have to get past IMUS. That's all. It's like, this is a really big deal. This could be the end of an administration. I mean, this is...
Even if they say that they did it so that they could conduct RNC business, if you find any other business, and the AttorneyGate is an example, on there, it means that they bypassed the rules that they're supposed to follow.
Yeah, they have violated the Presidential Records Act. Absolutely, Scott, spot on and well said. Joe in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Sure. Really enjoy your show, by the way.
Thank you.
One of the things I wanted to point out is nothing is ever lost on the Internet. And
so they say.
If there's enough liberal IT guys out there listening that can get in there and find all these servers that all these messages were routed through, those emails are out there all over the world.
Yeah, that's, you know, on a certain level, that's kind of a scary thought. But, yeah, it must be. Thank you. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Jeff?
Well, we have to keep on repeating that line, if you have nothing to hide. But reiterate what the last caller said.
If you have nothing to hide, you don't need an RNC email account if you're in the White House.
Yeah, all along there, what is anybody hiding? That's what as you mentioned earlier, is a con talking point. Anyway, reiterating what this last IT guy said, considering the number of accounts and all the servers going through there, and that people are going to be accessing their mail oftentimes from multiple machines, there are probably over 100 computers out there with this information on in one way or another. They could not, I mean, it would be absolutely impossible for them to have lost all these emails.
Yeah, well, we'll see what they're saying, because they're saying right now, whoop, it looks like they're gone. But, you know, from your lips to God's ears, Jeff, hopefully you're right. Pat in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Pat.
Hi, Tom. First of all, thanks for your work. Secondly, I'd like to remind everybody, I believe I'm right in this, that Nixon was brought up on his impeachment for bombing Cambodia as well as the Watergate matter. And I think it's interesting the parallel between we may catch Bush or Bush may be brought up for impeachment because of the Alberto Gonzalez thing. But his invading Iraq, which didn't attack us, too, seems awfully similar to me with our bombing Cambodia.
Yeah, the parallels between the Bush administration and the Nixon administration are spooky. And not only the parallels, the people, the same, there's some of the same people are being recycled. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible. Pat, thank you. Haskell in Los Angeles, you disagree.
Yes, yes. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Haskell.
Oh, hello. Even if they do impeach him, it won't help. I think they should let matters go as they are. And these countries should stand on their own and not expect any help. So I have a little ditty, if I may do it.
Okay. Haskell, thank you very much. Michael in Manchester, Michigan. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Well, I was a little bit worried about the way this thing was going until there was a story about one of the persons mentioned in a news article that was covering up and George Bush wanted to set her aside. Does the name... Harriet Myers mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah. This is where the whole thing started. Harriet Myers was the one who did the original cover-up for Bush. Bush, when Bush got into the Air National Guard, he jumped ahead of a whole bunch of people in order to do it because, you know, his daddy greased the skids. And the guy that his daddy greased the skids with came back later. Ben, what was his last name? In any case, he came back later and said... that he was the lobbyist for a lottery company that hadn't even bid to do the Texas lottery. We're talking about a multi-billion dollar business. Hadn't even bid. The contract had already been awarded. And Harriet Myers was the chairman of the Texas Lottery Commission, and she went in and she undid the competitive bid that had been awarded to one company and gave it to this guy's company, who was essentially blackmailing George W. Bush. And at Bush's request, the president, the chairman, the chairperson of the Texas Lottery protested. Harriet Myers fired that person, and Harriet Myers has been a loyal, you know, right there with Bush ever since. And I mean, that's absolutely the bottom line. Solidly, yes. Well, you know, good point. And in fact, I have a feeling a lot of this is going to come back to Harriet Myers. And, of course, Bush's attorney, Alberto Gonzalez, his private lawyer for the last, you know, all these governorship in Texas and as president. Ryan in Wyoming. Hey, Ryan.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Tom.
You are on the air, Ryan.
Yeah, okay. I was just wondering, after George Bush lied us into the Iraq War and, you know, has been the result of killing thousands of American soldiers, you know, for nothing but, you know, Halliburton and everything else, what makes anybody think that they can impeach Bush on the firing of eight U.S. attorneys? I mean,
because it's not just the firing of eight U.S. attorneys. It's two reasons. Number one, it's cumulative. I absolutely agree with you, Ryan, but it is a cumulative thing. First of all, there's this, just like it was with Nixon, there's this massive accumulation of stuff that has happened. And secondly, it is using political office governmental office, using the public trust for political ends. And that's something that Americans, Republicans and Democrats alike, are horrified by. Kathy in Detroit, just a few seconds here, Kathy, before we have to wrap up this hour.
Oh, great. Yes. I think Nixon is going to come out smelling like a rose compared to these thugs that are in the White House now. I said a long time ago when they first started their antics that we should get rid of them, throw the bums out, and everybody thought I was a little too radical. But it's nice to be right.
Yeah, Nixon, well said, Kathy. Nixon at least was a statesman at a certain level. I mean, Nixon represented the United States well around the world. Nixon opened China. You know, instead of saying, oh, they're our enemy, we'll only kill them or shoot them or bomb them, that's the only way you deal with them. No, he said, we'll talk to our enemies. We talked to the Soviet Union. Did he sign the EPA into law? 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
So what are the liberals up to now, or what are the conservatives up to, or what's going on here? Angela McLaughlin, the founder and president of Political Strategies and Insights, a Washington, D.C.-based government affairs and public relations consulting firm. She's also a Republican strategist, political analyst, and former legislative aide, and author of a new book, Bamboozled, How Americans Are Being Exploited by the Lies of the Liberal Agenda. It's available over at barnesandnoble.com. Angela, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
The focus of your book, you're African American, your picture is prominently on the front cover of your book, and the focus of your book seems to be that minorities are being inappropriately exploited by liberals.
Well, all Americans are being exploited by liberals, by the liberal mainstream media and agenda, but particularly minorities. And as an African American female, 90% of blacks vote a straight Democratic ticket. The Latino community is divided, and women, I interviewed in one chapter in my book, I dedicated totally to women, but throughout the book we have Latino themes, black themes, not African American. I don't believe in African American because I don't know what tribe I come from, but anyway, black themes.
Well, wouldn't that if you were identifying yourself by tribe, wouldn't that be like, you know, Bantu American or Zulu American or something like that? I mean, if you're, I don't understand why you would not say African American. My grandparents both came over here from Norway. I could say I'm a Norwegian American.
Yes, you can. But the thing is, in essence,
or a European
I'm not
American.
All,
I'm certainly
I am
European.
Not all. If I wanted to, Tom, I'm part Native American. And McLaughlin, we have Scotch-Irish in my family, too. So if I wanted to, I could claim that I'm Native American because I'm more so that than anything. But it says if you have 1 ounce of black blood in you, even mulatto children, you are considered as being black. So the term African American, Negro, we're all people. We're all Americans, and we're all a part of the human race. And I think sometimes we tend to segregate ourselves.
I agree with your sentiment at the end there, Angela, but the point of your book is that people who will call themselves African Americans or blacks or whatever are being exploited by the lies of the liberal agenda. I mean,
yes,
that's the point
are.
Of your book.
Yes, yes.
And what I'm baffled by is you talk about in your book at some length, actually, about the segregationist and racist past of the Democratic Party. And you're spot on right. The Democratic Party, you know, arose back in the late 1700s and became, throughout the early 1800s and up through the Civil War, the party of segregation, the party of slavery, frankly. And after the Civil War, they were the party that was still wanting to have slavery. You know, they were the party that fought the Republican Party, which was started in 1856 as a reform party, as a progressive party.
You were listening.
But the Republican Party in the 1880s sold out to big business. The Democratic Party was still the racist party. They continued that up until the 1960s. But then in 1964 and in 67, you know, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, when we had Bill Moyers on, and he as I recall, he was telling the story of how this piece of legislation was brought to Lyndon Johnson, and he was advised against signing it because they said, if you sign this, the Democratic Party will lose the South for a generation. And Johnson said, if that's the price we have to pay to have racial equality in this country, I'm willing to pay that price. And he signed the legislation. The Democratic Party went through a fundamental transformation in the 1960s, and Nixon said, look at all these white racists left over in the South that are being ignored by the Democrats. Now we'll pick them up. And the Republicans called that their Southern strategy, and they're still playing that card.
Here's the deal, my friend. First of all, let's look at the true thing. And when you read my book, again, Tom, you've been bamboozled. That's what Lyndon Baines Johnson said on the record. But we have quotes from his black driver who wrote a book, who he said that Johnson called him the N-word so many times that he didn't even know what his true name was, number one. Number two, when a staffer asked Johnson why did he appoint Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court? He said, son, when I appoint an N to the Supreme Court, I want America to know that he's an N. It's in my book. Secondly,
let's assume that LBJ is an evil guy. Let's assume he's an evil guy. The fact of the matter is the Democratic Party. Let me finish, Angela.
LBJ, when he was senator, never voted for a civil...
Angela, I'm going to pause you right there because we have another 4.5 minutes and we're not going to filibuster each other, neither one of us. I'm going to put you back on the air right now, and I just want to say, let's assume that LBJ was an evil guy. I'll give you that. He had a long history of being a racist in Texas, but what he did was signed legislation, and he took the Democratic Party in a completely new direction.
Tom, let's move to the Nixon administration since you interrupted me on explaining to you how the bill came. And I was going to say that Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, actually helped him get the bill through for LBJ. Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, was his lobbyist, and Robert Byrd filibustered the civil rights bill, who's a Democrat still today in the Senate, and Fulbright and Albert Gore Sr. were the ones with him fighting against the bill, all Democrats. But go to the Nixon administration. That's where affirmative action was created by a black man, Art Fletcher. So the bottom line is
And you're opposed to affirmative action.
See, you got to read the book. I'm opposed to affirmative action quotas. But
well, that's, you know, I did spend considerable time with your book, actually, this morning, and reading it, I very strongly got the sense that you were opposed to
quotas.
You call them quotas. You're saying any affirmative action program that is actually an
quotas.
Affirmative action program, that's what you're opposed to.
No, I said affirmative action quotas. There's a difference. When you have blatant racism there, the federal government should move in and do an investigation and an affirmative action mandate. But when you have quotas where people are hired or people are entered into our school system, our college system, because standards are lowered, then I think that that's blatant prejudice against other people. I don't want anybody lowering a standard for me to get in or hiring me because I'm a black female. I want them to hire me because I'm qualified for the job. Because
so you think all the vestiges of racism are gone?
No, my friend. Oh, it is not a level playing field out there. No, my friend.
Then why should there not be a change? Why should there not be let's cut them a break and let some folks in who have been the victims of this institutionalized racism that we still have. I mean, this is how Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, for example, they were both the recipients of, or beneficiaries, let's say, of affirmative action programs.
How do we know that Condoleezza Rice benefited? I mean, I know that Colin Powell did, but how do we know that Condoleezza Rice did? I mean, is that quoted anywhere that she...
I,
benefited from affirmative action. Was she just brilliant? And that's how she got into Stanford at 15, because she was just brilliant. The bottom line is
wrong.
This. That I said, how do we know? I didn't say yay or nay. I just said, how do we know that? I mean, I haven't read it anywhere that she advanced through affirmative action programs, but I've heard Colin Powell actually promote affirmative action. Again,
sure.
I'm against affirmative action quotas because I don't want anybody doing anything for me. And in America, my parents, who fought hard in the civil rights movement in the state of Mississippi, when I was born, taught me, and that's where I'm from, Mississippi, that I am an American first, and I just happen to be black. And in America, if you work hard, if you're honest, and you get an education, and you set goals for yourself, you can make it, and that's how I've made it.
And we all agree we would love to see that America, but I don't think we're there yet.
Well, you know what? I'm very positive, and I think once people read my book, and again, I don't want people to read my book and say, oh, golly gee, I need to join the Republican Party. I want people to read this book. And in my book, I have 400 endnotes, and I interviewed over 60 Democrats,
sure,
Republicans.
But you constantly throughout the book are pointing out the racist past of the Democratic Party,
yep,
and how the Republican Party is, and you know, how liberal economic policies bankrupt blacks, loot Latinos,
yep,
and wreck women's wallets.
Because I work.
Are you talking about tax cuts for billionaires and multimillionaires and income? And Reagan's
Capitol
doubling Social Security taxes and all the rest of us?
Tom, you know what? Fox News was fair and balanced. But I tell you, my friend, if you want to have a platform, go right ahead. But if you want to ask me a question and ask me about my book and let me answer you, I will do that.
Did.
So I'll be quiet and you go ahead
we
and
have,
ask me.
I just did. How? And we have 45 seconds, by the way. How is it that liberal policies are bankrupting blacks, looting Latinos, and wrecking women's values?
Because
it looks
7 out of 10 black babies are born out of wedlock today, and a majority of them, any child born out of wedlock, 75% of them are in poverty in the inner city. Liberals want us to have a dependency net where conservatives give us a ladder to look up and look up to success.
What is that ladder that conservatives are giving you?
Me working on Capitol Hill on the Ways and Means Committee, I saw President Clinton sign 70% of Newt Gingrich's contract with America. That's how I know, because I lived it.
What is the ladder that conservatives are offering?
From the standpoint of self-reliance, self-sufficiency, welfare reform gave us the tools to build the house instead of giving us the house.
So the latter is good luck.
$500 per child tax credit gave us a tax credit for giving us money back when we have children to be able to count that on our taxes, Tom.
Okay.
I want you to go
Angela
back to
McGlaughan, her book, I will check it out. Angela McGlaughan, her book, Bamboozled, How Americans Are Being Exploited by the Lies of the Liberal Agenda. You can find it over at barnesandnoble.com. Angela, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way, and God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise. We're living on the edge.
So George W. Bush's ambassador to the Sudan says there's no genocide in Darfur. This is apropos of nothing we've been talking about, just breaking in the news right now. The guy testifying before Congress this morning, Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. Do you consider the ongoing situation in Darfur a genocide, yes or no? Natsios, who's Bush's ambassador to the Sudan, there's very little violence in Darfur right now. It continues. He repeats it several times. And by the way, just to recap my discussion with Angela McGlaughan, who in her book does a marvelous job of putting out essentially the Fox News talking points, the Republican Party talking points. The conservative position on all of this is good luck, Charlie. I mean, you're on your own, no matter what. There is some virtue, I think, in suggesting that Americans and people of all stripe, you know, people all around the world to a large extent, but just say Americans should pull themselves up by their bootstraps and should do the best they can. And it's a marvelous excuse for large corporate powers and for institutions of governance that want to say, you know, sorry, see you later. We're going to, you know, help billionaires and millionaires. We're going to make sure. I mean, look at what the Bush administration has done. They have cut the capital gains tax and the dividend tax to 15%, whereas the income tax is in the high, is in the mid-30s. So if you work for a living, you're paying 30-plus percent income tax. If you sit on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive for a living, you're making 15%. I don't understand how that would be of benefit to minorities or anybody else, frankly, other than of, you know, of less than 0.1% of Americans, less than 0.01% of Americans, the millionaires and billionaires. I don't get it. And I say, you know, name a program. I'm not hearing an answer. So back to the issue that we brought up in the first hour of the program also. I want to make this a through line throughout the program today, because this is such a big deal that the whole issue of impeachment, that this Nixon, it was yesterday, 33 years ago yesterday, that Nixon was subpoenaed by the House Judiciary Committee. It was day before yesterday that the Senate Judiciary Committee subpoenaed this White House, George W. Bush, and said, you will supply us with these internal communications. Oh, no. We had those on the Republican National Committee servers, and they seem to be missing now. And Pat Leahy on the floor of the Senate today, he says, they say they've not been preserved. I don't believe that. You can't erase emails. Not today. They've gone through too many servers. Those emails are there. They just don't want to produce them. We'll subpoena them if necessary. Like the famous 18-minute gap in the Nixon White House tapes, it appears that key documentation has been erased or misplaced. This sounds like the administration's version of the dog ate my homework. Well said. And the Senate Judiciary Committee is authorizing Pat Leahy, in consultation with ranking member Arlen Specter, to issue subpoenas for more Justice Department documents related to this whole U.S. attorney scandal. This, in my opinion, this is going to end up going all the way up to the top, all the way to the White House. All the way to George W. Bush. And some interesting thoughts on this. First of all, Larry Johnson over at noquarter.typepad.com, his blog. He points out that in 2003, the White House was subpoenaed by Patrick Fitzgerald for all of their emails that might have to do with the Valerie Plame case. The only ones they turned over were the ones from whitehouse.gov. So apparently the White House is in violation, that would include Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, in violation of the original subpoena back in 2003, 4 years ago, that was given to the White House with regard to the outing of Valerie Plame. And then the conspiracy theories begin. Donald in Augusta, Georgia, for example, he says that in his opinion, the reason why the Democrats impeached Bill Clinton in the House of Representatives was not because they thought they could convict him in the Senate, not because they wanted to remove him from office even, but instead because they wanted to poison the word impeachment. They wanted Americans, and they were willing to suffer the temporary pain of it. They wanted Americans to experience an impeachment as a political process, so in the future, if anybody talked about impeachment, the immediate assumption of Americans would be that it was a political process, that it was all about partisanship, it was all about payback, it was all about taking somebody down. And therefore, if the democratically led Congress had any ethics at all, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't engage in that kind of partisan bickering, that kind of partisan backstabbing. Donald, I think you might have a point there. Because the Republicans did succeed by impeaching Bill Clinton, and they did impeach him. They did not convict him in the Senate, but they did impeach him in the House of Representatives successfully. What they succeeded in doing by impeaching Bill Clinton is caused Americans to think that, oh, impeachment, that's what you do with somebody you don't like politically to try and take them down. And thus Democrats are afraid to go down that road for fear of being viewed as if they were Republicans. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Do you believe in the magic of democracy? Do you believe in the magic of impeachment? Do you believe in the magic of affirmative action? The emergence of a large black middle class in the United States, and there is one, I believe tracks back, right smack back to the 60s. And the signing of, you know, Lyndon Johnson cutting poverty in half in the United States in a four-year period, the signing of the Civil Rights Act, the Voter Rights Act, things like this, and just it's good stuff, in my opinion. John in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Yeah,
hey, John.
Thanks again. I called you the first time yesterday. I'm calling you again. And this was in reference to Mrs. McGowan. Is that correct?
Yeah, McGowan, actually.
Right. And, I'm an African-American, and she is so far off base, but she didn't live through those periods as I did, and she doesn't remember the Iran-Contra and probably doesn't recognize the significance of Bush pardoning those people involved and then the possibility that cocaine ended up on the streets of the possibility of Los Angeles by virtue of right-wing theoreticians and politicians, but I would like to mention a couple of facts that she should be aware of, one of which is the lynching of Emmett Till in the 50s. The conservative right-wing, at that time, Democratic South, freed his tormentors and murderers, and liberals risked their life to go down there and try to contact witnesses. And then there was the Scottsboro case, where the conservative South would have lynched those guys, but liberals went down there. There was school integration, where little children were egged and beaten and shouted at and screamed and through horrible ordeal just to walk into a public school. That was those were conservative actions, and it was a liberal Supreme War in court.
Yeah, and this was, John, this was within your lifetime and mine.
Oh, you're damn right. How about the Tuskegee experiment where African-American men were allowed to carry syphilis at a time when penicillin was available to all sorts of people? They were in a conservative South, Tuskegee, Alabama.
Right, and so the question that...
It was a liberal who spotted that.
And blew the whistle on it. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why the question that I ask is, and I think it's a legitimate and honest one, is given that this happened, these things that you've just done such a marvelous job of chronicling, John, that these things happened in your lifetime and mine, when people who have gone through that, people who have lived through that, and in many cases, you know, a few people were able to overcome the adversity of that, and God bless them. But a lot of people were destroyed by the adversity of that.
And a lot of
those people had children and grandchildren, and how can you expect those children to start from the same block, the same starting block, as somebody who grows up white middle class in America? I don't get it.
I have a suspicion, and I say this respectfully, but there's money in the Republican camp, and there's more than one African-American or Spanish-American or people from other groups, including Anglos, who have opted against their true interest for their group interest for personal gain. And I'm not saying that that's true of your guest.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that of Angela. And I think that there are also a lot of people who actually drank the Kool-Aid, who just really believe the right-wing spin. And I don't just suspect she's one. I mean, I've read probably 20% of her book this morning. I think she's a true believer. I think she really believes what she's saying. And in that regard, I actually have a certain amount of respect for her for that. But
I'm an African-American, and I have an antenna that you may not have.
Okay.
And I wish I could share your trust and belief in this woman.
Yeah. Well, I honor your antenna, John, and I don't mean that, you know, in a sarcastic way.
I understand.
I truly do. And I'll have to defer to that because you're
okay.
Absolutely right. I haven't had your life's experience. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Tim in San Jose, California. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. If you'd pick up the phone, though, I could hear you better. I think Tim was trying to pick up the phone, and off he went. Kevin in Washington, D.C. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. This is Kevin from Washington. Mm-hmm. I just want to say this is something that has been going on for centuries, even back to slavery, where the conservatives will treat a few better than the masses to show that their institutions work on behalf of those they're exploiting.
Yeah.
Okay? In the Old South, they took a few, you know, and treated them better than the masses, and said, well, you know, slavery is a humane thing for black people. As we all know, that it wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it was a brutal.
And that's what made the foundation of the black middle class, was those slaves who were treated better, mainly the house slaves and whatever. And that's what it was.
The early black middle class.
Yes, the early black middle class.
Yeah, I'd say the modern middle class was black middle class came
about as a consequence. It's a mass thing.
As the Voter Rights Act and Affirmative Action Program.
Yeah, and plus, any institution that has gone out to disenfranchise 99.9%, and this is what the Republican Party does today, they are actively disenfranchising the black vote. Black Republicans don't have a leg to stand on. And I'm sorry, I cannot even begin to entertain anything this woman has to say. As far as I'm concerned, she's the black Ann Coulter.
Okay, Kevin. Yeah, just look at you know, in Florida, you know, 70,000-80,000 African Americans. No, you can't vote. In Ohio, no, you can't vote. Yeah, good point. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Hey, Paula.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just fine. What's up?
I just wondered, like, how'd that Republican ladder out of poverty work for the survivors of Katrina?
Well, I think that you see a great example of how, you know, exactly how it doesn't work. I mean, that's the point. The idea of just pull yourself up by your bootstraps assumes that you have some bootstraps.
And not only that, the increase in the numbers of people in abject poverty over the course of the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And the Republican-controlled Congress. How can she say that? Like, how could she make those comments?
Well, I don't know. I apparently it's consistent with her life experience. I think that there are some people who are born into the middle class and think that everybody else is like that, and maybe they just don't see what's going on in the rest of America. I don't know, Paula, but thank you for your call and for your comments. Sean in Portland. Hey, Sean, you want to disagree with me?
Yes. Hey, Tom, why did you throw out Condoleezza Rice's name as a recipient of affirmative action? Is that something that you know as a fact?
Because she gave a number of talks about affirmative action, one with CBS, one with Urban Radio, in which she supported affirmative action. And my understanding, and frankly I believed it to be true, was that she had been a beneficiary of affirmative action. When Angela McLaughlin said that I was wrong on that, I said, okay, I may have been wrong. I apologize.
See, I think you proved her point about affirmative action as being racist by, she had you backed up against a corner, and you threw out two names of people, especially Condoleezza Rice, who we know that you don't like because she's a Republican.
Condoleezza Rice has spoken out in favor of affirmative action. Your statement was that Condoleezza Rice needs
Whitey to help her out. And I think that's racist.
Sean.
Yeah, that's what
Sean,
I
give me a break. Yeah, okay. Well, so that's what you think. All right. Thanks a lot. I'm Mark in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. First, I have a riddle for you.
Sure.
How do you know when you've had a Don Imus moment?
How's that?
When afterwards you say to yourself, wow, I must have done something wrong.
Okay.
Anyway, the affirmative action thing I'd like to talk about a little, very short. When someone such as Don Imus says something or does something that hurts people of, you know, racially or genderly, that may not be quantifiable for number type of being countering people such as that previous guest of yours, but it does inflict damage on society. And the leveling of the playing field, so to speak, that you've mentioned, seems to be needed when that kind of unleveling occurs all the time,
This is a quote from Condoleezza Rice's welcome statement on affirmative action in the president's amicus brief. She said, I believe that while race-neutral means are preferable, it is appropriate to use race as one factor among others in achieving a diverse student body. That's, you know, this is in support of affirmative action. That's a verbatim quote from Condi Rice.
Everything
but
in moderation.
But I also was just, you know, yeah, I was just Googling this, and apparently the Condi Rice was the recipient of affirmative action started with Michael Savage. So in that, if that's the case, man, I so apologize for repeating anything that Michael Savage said. Richard in North Bergen, thanks a lot for the call. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Got to take a break here in just a minute, Richard. What's up?
Yeah, just I take exception a little bit with about your characterization of the Democratic Party in the 60s.
In the South.
I was saying
the Democratic Party in the South.
And there was two Democratic parties, the National Party and the Dixiecrats, named by Truman in the South. And all those Democrats, the Dixiecrats, as I call them, all became Republicans after Johnson.
Yeah, that was Nixon's Southern strategy, was to pick them up. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. No, that was my point. I think we're...
Without exception, except for Byrd and a couple others. What he did years ago, years later.
Oh, yeah, but Robert Byrd has undergone what I think is a true conversion. I mean, he has truly changed, and, you know, one hopes that Don Imus will do the same. I mean, that's where somebody really gets it, that they've been going down the wrong road, and they say, okay, that's it. I'm becoming a different person. And I'm going to go down a different road. And that's, you know, clearly what Robert Byrd did. 45 minutes past the hour. Let's fire up this country, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. On April 15th, on Sunday, April 15th, at 4 p.m., I'll be in Phoenix, Arizona for the first anniversary party of 1480 KPHX. Mike Malloy, Stephanie Miller, Bill Press, Jeff Farias, and 1,500 of our closest friends celebrate the radio station's first year on the air, Progressive Talk Radio. And so drop by, hang out with us and the staff and fellow progressives. For more details and hotel accommodations and all that kind of thing, go to 1480kphx.com. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. Today, the Deputy Press Secretary, Scott Stanzel, was defending what's going on with these emails. This was this morning at the Gaggle. And apparently there was a conference call yesterday with reporters who, quote-unquote, have been following this issue, except that people like Talk Radio News, NBC, and CNN were excluded. And Talk Radio News, via Victoria, has been one of the ones that has been asking about whether these emails were sent through the George W. Bush 2006 campaign, 2004 campaign, and all of the other campaign various emails put together by the RNC.
Therefore, your exclusion, perhaps.
Exactly. Scott was asked about whether that some of these emails could have done with the dealt with U.S. attorneys. He said, "Well, that couldn't be ruled out." Then he was asked about there. He said, "There's 22 people in the of the 1,000 political appointees in the White House that have been provided with email accounts." And then, of course, the reporters this morning said to him, "Well, who are they? Who are these 22 people?" Well, he was going to check and see if he could get a list. But my guess is we're not going to see that list.
You know, yesterday was the 33rd anniversary of the subpoenaing of Richard Nixon for the additional Watergate tapes by the House Judiciary Committee. And four and a half months later, he resigned from office.
Well, this is something that is definitely larger than anybody expects. And now they said, well, now we've given instructions that people are not supposed to delete their emails because they may be used. I mean, come on. A little, yeah. This is like closing the barn door after the horse is out.
Yeah, I think this is going to be the smoking gun. But there's also this cumulative effect. Nixon had lost a lot of support across America because of his Vietnam policies, and Watergate was just the straw that broke the camel's back, I would submit.
Well,
and this is the same thing, right?
It's interesting because when Victoria asked that question, it was the second day, I think, right before Tony left for his surgery. And he looked at Victoria like she was nuts when she brought this up. And so she walked up to him and said, you know, Tony, Ellen and I have really wondered about this, and this is really important. And he said, he just looked at her like he didn't have any idea what she was talking about when she talked about using the other, the RNC computers, and their email.
Maybe
so,
he didn't.
I'm sorry?
I mean, maybe this was all stuff that started under Scott McClellan.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Tony necessarily knew, but it is interesting that, you know, we pressed on this, and obviously we were right.
Right, and therefore you were not invited to be part of the press conference yesterday. That's very interesting. By the way, just out of curiosity, how is Tony Snow doing?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, he's in recovery, and we have not yet heard what his treatment is going to be. So people are not sort of saying much. People are hoping he shows up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but again, it's going to depend how he's doing.
As a fellow human being, we all wish him well.
Tony's really a nice guy. I've known him for 10 years. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen that job, but hey, I'm not a Republican. Yeah. Couple other interesting things of the 100-day anniversary of Democrats being in power is tomorrow. The Republicans are planning on going after the Democrats for quote-unquote raising taxes. Well, they haven't raised taxes. They just haven't passed the president's continued tax package. But they're going to talk about it as raising taxes. They're planning on getting on radio, television, doing a whole thing on this. And they're also going to obviously go after the war supplemental, and they're going to talk about the Democrats aren't doing enough for the economy. Meanwhile, the Democrats had their own meeting today in Harry Reid's office, and they talked about the fact that they have actually really spent time trying to do oversight on the Iraq war, that they've had 58 more oversight hearings on Iraq than the Republicans did in the last Congress, because of course they didn't do any. And they talked about the veterans hospitals and Walter Reed. And apparently Dick Durbin spent Easter week going to veterans hospitals and says he was very shocked that there really isn't enough money. Senator Schumer said that Bush is really alone right now in his bunker on the issue of the war supplemental, and that they are going to talk to the president about this next week when they go to the White House, even if the president doesn't want to.
Interesting. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go for it.
Well, I'm just Pat Leahy came out today. He gave a speech on the floor of the Senate, in which he said that this is back to the email story here, that this is the equivalent of the dog ate my homework kind of thing. And at what point, how much time does the White House have before they have to, you know, fish or cut bait, or whatever the appropriate cliche is here? They have to actually provide these emails or say, sorry, we don't have them. If they say, sorry, we don't have them, what happens?
Well, that's a good question, because the Republican National Committee server is in Tennessee, and that is where GWB, 2004 is, and all the different re-elect the president or whatever new monikers they have for emails. Now, the question is whether those servers can somehow be subpoenaed. Can they be wiped clean? Do they store these emails? That's the question. The White House said that they are trying to answer that question now.
Yeah. And
I'm sure they're trying real hard.
This just has so many echoes of Nixon. I'm just boggled
by it.
Does the rest of the press corps get it?
Oh, they get it completely and totally.
Is this story going to eclipse Imus? I mean, is this going to come back into the mainstream media?
Well, I think that depends on the other editors. But I think in terms of the White House press room, that's all anybody's talking about.
Interesting. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
At the core of this whole email scandal and Lawyergate issue, at the real core of this is not just what happened to the lawyers who were fired, I mean, what did they do to get them fired? There's some where it's, I think, becoming increasingly obvious. Carol Lamb, for example, how dare she prosecute Republicans? Put Duke Cunningham, a sitting member of Congress from the Republican Party, in prison? How dare she? And then she's looking into Jerry Lewis, congressman from California. Oh, get her out of here in a hurry. But what's even more interesting are all the federal prosecutors who stayed in office who were doing what the Bush administration wanted. And the focus, it is becoming increasingly apparent, of what they wanted to do was track down major felonies like Kimberly Prude or Usman Ali or Rogelio Mejora Lopez. You've never heard of these people? Well, they're not, you know, exactly friends of Osama's or anything like that. These are people who have been convicted of illegally voting. For example, Kimberly Prude, she's 43 years old. She's been sitting in jail in Milwaukee for a year, more than a year. Why? Because while she was on probation, she voted. Ms. Prude, this is from today's New York Times. An article by Eric Lipton and Ian Urbina. The headline, in five-year efforts, scant evidence of voter fraud. Ms. Prude said she believed that she was permitted to vote because she was not in jail and she was not on parole, she testified in court. Told by her probation officer that she could not vote, she said she immediately called City Hall to rescind her vote, a step she was told by City Hall was not necessary. I made a mistake, like I said, and I truly apologize for it, Ms. Prude said during her trial in 2005. They sent her to jail for a year anyway. Voting fraud. Usman Ali, a legal immigrant here in the United States. He was in Florida. He'd lived in Florida for a decade. When he renewed his driver's license, which he could legally do as a legal resident of the United States. This is a fellow who's a native of Pakistan. Here, legally. When he renewed his driver's license, he checked the box that said, yes, also register me to vote. They tracked him down and deported him to Pakistan. They held a trial, they convicted him of vote fraud, and sent him to Pakistan, where he's trying to rebuild his life without the rest of his family and the whole everything that he's built for over a decade in the United States. In Alaska, Rogelio Mejorada-Lopez, a Mexican who legally lives in the United States. Again, legally. These are people with green cards. May soon face a similar fate because he voted even though he was not eligible. They found a guy. They found a guy in Mexico, in Alaska. Richard Hansen, an expert in election law at the Loyola Law School, says if they found a single case of a conspiracy to affect the outcome of a congressional election or a statewide election, that would be significant. But what we see is isolated, small-scale activities that have not shown any kind of criminal intent. In fact, here's the opening of this. 5 years after the Bush administration began a crackdown on voter fraud, the Justice Department has turned up virtually no evidence of any organized effort to skew federal elections, according to court records and interviews. Now, of course, the Justice Department has not investigated the Republican Party. They have not looked into what happened in Florida during Jeb Bush's administration. They have not looked into what happened in Ohio under Ken Blackwell. And in fact, as Lipton and Urbina point out in today's New York Times, although Republican activists have repeatedly said fraud is so widespread that it has corrupted the political process and possibly cost the Republican Party election victories, 5 years now, the Bush administration cracking down on voter fraud, all these federal prosecutors looking for people who accidentally checked the box that said, yes, sign me up to vote when they renewed their driver's license, but they were here with a green card. Or people who were out of jail after having committed a crime and were no longer on parole or probation and thought that they could legally vote, Here's in Wisconsin. One ex-convict was so unfamiliar with the rules that he provided his prison-issued identification card stamped offender when he tried to register just before voting. I mean, these are just simple mistakes that could be stopped, that could be ended, that could be blocked by a registrar's, election registrar saying, that your ID says offender on it, sir. I'm sorry. You can't, you know, in this state, you can't vote. And frankly, I would submit to you that in and of itself is a travesty. I thought that in the United States of America, when you had paid back your debt to society, you were reintegrated as a member of society. As a full member of society with full rights. I thought that was the American way. It's not in about half the states. In Miami, an assistant United States attorney said many cases there involve what were apparently mistakes by immigrants, not fraud. In Wisconsin, where prosecutors have lost almost twice as many cases as they have won, charges were brought against voters who filled out more than one registration form and felons seemingly unaware that they were barred from voting. So, for example, I moved out here to Oregon from Vermont, and I got a driver's license. And I frankly don't remember if when I got a driver's license, I could have checked a box to become a registered voter or not. The honest truth, I don't remember if I did that or not. Now, apparently I did because I got a ballot, which is good. I figured, you know, if the ballot didn't come, I was going to go down and re-register. And I thought I had, but, you know, I couldn't, you know. And so if I had walked by one of these, hey, register to vote here places, and somebody said, are you registered to vote in Oregon? I may well have said, you know, I'm not really certain. Well, fill this out. If there was a federal prosecutor here doing what the Bush administration wants, they'd throw my butt in jail. Instead of simply saying, looking at the voter list and say, oh, this guy's re-registered. He must have thought he must have forgot that he registered, or he must have not known that you get registered automatically when you get your driver's license, or something like that. As the New York Times points, and keep in mind, this, when you start unraveling this whole Votergate thing, or this whole, email gate thing, or Gonzalez gate, or whatever it's going to become, just like with Watergate, Watergate was about tracking the Democratic Party. It was about trying to create a permanent Republican majority in the United States. Ultimately, apparently, so that they could do what Bush has done, which is roll back civil rights in the United States, roll back civil liberties in the United States, roll back democracy, small d democracy in this small r republic, and say, ah, to hell with the voters, we don't need them. We've got a Supreme Court that'll tell us who should be president. And so you look at what happened with Nixon and Watergate, and it was the exact same agenda, which was creating that permanent Republican majority, as the agenda right now of these 93 prosecutors who were appointed by the Bush administration and then leaned on very, very, very heavily by Gonzalez to do this kind of prosecution instead of looking at actual crimes. As Eric Clifton and Ian Urbina write in today's New York Times, previously charges were generally brought just against conspiracies to corrupt the election process, not against individual offenders, Craig DeSanto, head of the Elections Crime Branch, told a panel investigating voter fraud last year. For deterrence, Mr. DeSanto said, Attorney General Alberto R. Gonzalez authorized prosecutors to pursue criminal charges against individuals. Now, the question, I guess, for you. Are you a registered voter? Are you sure you haven't registered twice? Are you willing to go to jail if somebody walks up to you at a shopping mall and says, hey, you want to register to vote, and you're not sure? Because the Republicans don't want you to vote. They know that the smaller the number of voters there are, the smaller the overall base of voters, the more likely it is that they'll be able to win, because you can fool some of the people all of the time. And that's what they're all about, is fooling some of the people all the time. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
So 5 years after the Bush administration starts this crackdown on voter fraud, see, you have, they got nothing. They got nothing. They've got this poor woman in Minneapolis who's been thrown into jail because she voted after she was off parole. She goes into court and she apologizes. When her parole officer says, or probation officer, whatever, says to her, no, you can't vote, even though you're not in jail anymore and you're not on parole anymore, she calls up City Hall and says, you know, can I retract my vote? And they said, no, you don't need to do that. By the way, you're going to jail for voting for over a year. So meanwhile, while this is happening, the White House, the Republican Party, trying to, as aggressively as they can, discourage people from voting, particularly people whose skin may not be totally white, and who may not be middle or upper middle class or millionaires or billionaires. Bush's notorious or famous base. At the same time, there are some real problems going on in the world. In Karachi, Pakistan, and I find it interesting that this is by and large being ignored by the American media. The Asia Times probably had the best piece on this. In Pakistan, there is a standoff going on over a mosque that is pitting a group of Islamic fundamentalists. It's called the Red Mosque. It's in the center of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. It's the local name of it is the Lal Masjid, the Red Mosque. And it's affiliated madrasa, it's seminary, the Jamia Hafsa. Now, these folks are the folks who, out of this mosque, who in the 1990s planned an Islamic coup before this from the Asia Times. I'll just read this straight out. Waiting and watching developments are remnants of the military elite of the 1990s who planned an Islamic coup before Musharraf seized power in 1999, the Jamaat-e-Islami Pakistan, J.I., Islamist Political Party. Now, many top generals and bureaucrats attended Friday prayers in this particular mosque. These included disgraced nuclear scientist Abdul Kir Khan, remember Dr. Khan, the nuclear scientist, who frequently contributed to the needs of the seminary by donating books, food, and construction material. The people who run this mosque now, the sons of Mulana Abdullah, also support the cause of jihad and earn respect from such people as Osama bin Laden and his deputy, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. So these folks are creating this standoff right now in this mosque, calling for a declaration in Pakistan of Sharia law throughout the country. They are challenging the legality of the Pakistani government. Last Friday, the chief cleric, this is from the Asia Times, the chief cleric of Lal Masjid, Maulana Abdul Aziz, announced the setting up of a Taliban-style vigilante Islamic court and vows suicide bomb attacks if the authorities try to crack down on the mosque and its followers. Also last Friday, Aziz's brother, Ghazi Abdul Rashid, gave the government a month to either follow Sharia law or see it enforced through the mosque's parallel system. Already, girls from the Jamia Hafsa, backed by their male counterparts from Jamia Fridia, another religious institution administered by the Lal Masjid, had been roving through Islamabad, asking music and video shop owners to close down their businesses. They are fielding vice and virtue squads. And they say, General President General Pervez Musharraf has so far resisted the temptation to use force and was due on Wednesday, that would be yesterday, to receive advice from his cabinet on ways to defuse the situation. We still haven't heard what happened. But what they did do is they canceled the legal registration of the seminaries. They said, you're no longer legal. And so this is something, you know, to keep an eye on, to let's, you know, see what's going on in Pakistan. This is a dangerous situation. And in the meantime, over in the Washington Post, Dan Frumkin in his Washington Post online column, writing about how the White House, he says, federal law requires the preservation of electronic communications sent or received by the White House staff. This is the handbook that all staffers are given. This is, as a result, personnel working on behalf of the executive office of the president are expected to use only government-provided email services for all official communication. That's in the handbook, the official White House handbook, the official executive office handbook. The official EOP email system is designed to automatically comply with records management requirements. This is pretty unambiguous. In fact, it says commercial or free email sites and chat rooms are blocked from the EOP network to help staff members ensure compliance and to prevent the circumvention of the records management requirements. You say, what? So, let's go after voters. Let's not go after election fraud. Let's do go after so-called voter fraud. Let's ignore what's going on in the world. And by the way, the major Republican talking point coming down the road right now, I'll share it with you right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Hey, join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia, by the way, for a conference, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. It's good, June 3rd through the 9th of this year. Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Morlepe, Swami Beyondananda, and me, among others. You can get all the information over at praxispeace.org. This is the Praxis Peace Conference, P-R-A-X-I-S. Peace, P-E-A-C-E, .O-R-G. Maggie in Battleground, Pennsylvania. Hey, Maggie, welcome to the program.
Well, actually, it's Battleground, Indiana, but that's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
You know, with the voter fraud, why isn't Ann Coulter in jail?
You're right. I had forgotten about that she had apparently voted illegally. Yeah, if they got some poor woman in Minnesota in jail for a year over this. Well, Ann is a good Republican, though, and she's a Fox contributor. So, Maggie, I'm guessing that probably has something to do with it. Thanks a lot for the call. It's Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Fine.
Listen, I just wanted to say I think this Gonzales Gate is shaping up really, really nicely. It looks a lot like we're going to have the same kind of thing as we had with Watergate. And what I think is they're going to refuse to give a lot of the documents that are needed, or at least to give them in their complete form. And they're also going to refuse to supply witnesses that are subpoenaed. So I think we can count on this going to the Supreme Court. And with all that in mind, it seems to me that what needs to begin here, I think a lot of Americans don't know that it's not just the president and vice president who can be impeached. Gonzales can be impeached.
Sure, and a federal officer.
That's right. So I think what needs to happen in the House is that they need to begin an impeachment inquiry after his testimony next week, if he ever testifies. But if he does, and if he continues to fight on and to stay in the office and all that, they should begin an impeachment inquiry. And he's already been shown, I think, they could charge perjury at this point as the initial thing they're going to investigate. And with that in mind, with the inquiry, impeachment inquiry, if they had that as their basis for the need for records, when they go before the Supreme Court, that gives them, I think, even added leverage and added weight for their need for the records.
It was a criminal inquiry in the case of Watergate that caused the Supreme Court to rule against Richard Nixon, and that's, frankly, I think that's what needs to be happening, and that's the direction it certainly appears to me that they're moving in. Thank you very much for the call. Rick in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Rick.
Hi. I'd just like to say I'm in Oregon. You know, we have all absentee ballots, so I don't know if that improves the situation at all. But But every time I got off the light rail here in Portland, I registered with one of those kids that runs up to you and says, "Have you registered yet?" Because there was all these shenanigans going on in 2004. So I just wanted to make sure that I was registered. I only have one Social Security number. So what's it going to hurt if we've got a good grasp on computer information systems?
So how many times, Rick, keep in mind, I'm not going to give out your phone number here, but Alberto may be listening. How many times did you register to vote?
Oh, at least 5.
And did you get more than one ballot in the mail?
I got one ballot.
Yeah, so apparently Oregon has figured this out, and apparently whoever the federal prosecutor is who's parked in this neck of the woods has not been successful in pursuing these kinds of inquiries, and maybe that's something that would cause the Bush administration to say, hey, wait a minute, and throw the bomb out. In fact, wasn't the federal prosecutor in the Oregon-Washington area one of those who was canned?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't specifically recall. I'll have to check on that. But, Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting. Steve in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Hey, I wanted to talk about extending the troops of duty. I think it's the last desperate step before a draft. And
100% of the troops here. 145,000. 100% of the troops who are involved in the 145,000 people have had their tours of duty extended from 12 months to 15 months. This is so wrong. There are going to be so many divorces. There's going to be so many, just ruined lives. People who signed up. Well, don't get me started. Anyhow, you were saying.
And I think it's the last step before a draft, and I also want to bring in the war czar. I think whomever they appoint for this war czar will be the person that calls for the draft, and it'll be a less political fallout on the Bush administration.
Well, that's the point. We already have a war czar. It's called the commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
I mean, the Constitution says that the war czar is the president. The people elect him, and one of his duties is to be the commander-in-chief of the Navy and the military and the militia of the United States. And it's right there in the Constitution. And
it's like everything else. He's shirked his duties. He's shirking his duties now. He shirked his duties.
Yeah, well, when his oil company went bust, he got Osama bin Laden's half-brother, Salman bin Laden, to bail him out.
Modus operandi for that guy.
Yeah, it's tragic. Steve, thanks for the call. Mickey in Seattle. Hey, Mickey.
Yes, I beseech you to post your talking points on your website. I've been pretty much paralyzed since the 2000 coup d'etat, and I need an antidote for the ACLJ and the 700 Club and Fox and Friends. So I'd like to be able to communicate to the Senate and the House of Representatives, but I'd really like to be able to use your brain. Could you possibly do some drafting of little letters for me on your website?
Well, here's why you don't want me to do that, Mickey. When members of Congress get a letter that they've seen before, the more than one copy, they automatically discount what it says. And if I did that and more than one person copied it, then it would be diluting your impact. They take very, very seriously communication to their offices, particularly if you call the local office. If you call the local office of your two senators or your member of the House of Representatives.
Okay.
And also, if you want to contact Senators Leahy and Congressman Senator Leahy and Congressman Conyers
Jr.
Respective, the respective heads of the Senate and House Judiciary Committees who are doing these inquiries and who would be the places where impeachment would be initiated, then just call Washington, D.C. Phone calls actually have tremendous impact. Their telephone number is 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121.
And also, Mr. Hartman, does Congress have jurisdiction to go in and seize these computers from the administration and the executive office?
If they issue a subpoena, yes, they do. They do have the ability to do that. Mickey, thank you very much for the call. Ellen in Los Angeles. Hey, Ellen.
Hi, Tom. You have a great show, but I think you're being naive to think anything will happen. Watergate was a president who didn't have an establishment family. The Bush is establishment. There won't be any Pentagon Papers. There won't be a Republican who steps up to the plate. It's not going to happen.
Well, Ellen, you may well be right. I sure hope you're wrong. You may well be right. And it's one of the things that, frankly, concerns a lot of us. You're absolutely right. Bush is from the patriarchy, from the landed gentry, the nobility in America, and their family is absolutely interpenetrated by corporate America and all these interlocking boards and the hundreds and hundreds of millions of billions of dollars. Yeah.
And hope
springs eternal.
Okay.
I know Nixon didn't have that. Yeah, Nixon, you're right. And thank you, Ellen. Nixon was a poor kid who made good, and And, you know, in the most cynical view of America, that may be why Nixon went down and Bush won't. I hope not. Arguably, Bill Clinton didn't have that either. And, in fact, there are some people who wonder if the sudden Clinton-Bush senior friendship has to do with getting that, becoming part of a royal family. I don't know. It's frankly, a little bizarre to even consider. Maureen in Washington, D.C. Hey, Maureen.
Yes, Tom, I would just like to comment. I don't get your show live, so that this incident I hope isn't over with, but it's the Imus episode mm-hmm. that we've had. Yeah. I want to make a comment because every show on TV as well as talk radio, liberal media, has not mentioned that this Imus incident is not only a racial issue, but very much a woman issue. And I don't hear them saying, on that team, you know, there were actually, I believe, one, maybe two white girls as well on it. And the captain of the team made a comment that she was basically insulted as a woman. And yet right. not any of the shows, it's all about the race. When I'm saying, I beg your pardon, women have been, degraded so much. And I think it's time. This issue is coming to the fore in the nation. And I would like to see other women stand up and say, yes, I think it's enough. With the rap show music and these the conservative right talk hosts, coming on with calling Hillary Clinton the devil. And, I mean, to me, there's something very sick and wrong. So I would like to take the time to have this issue brought up as both a racial and woman issue.
I absolutely agree with you, Maureen. It is as much about sexism as it is about racism, and you made your point very eloquently. Thank you for doing so. Mark in San Diego. Hey, Mark, just a minute before we have to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, I was commenting about the lady that you had the author on, the African-American lady.
Angela McLaughlin, yes.
Yes. She made a point about Johnson using the N-word. The chauffeur says of Johnson said he used the N-word. But what documentation does she have of that?
Well, I'm perfectly willing to believe that Lyndon Johnson, you know, was a good old boy racist from the South. When he was a senator from Texas, he didn't have the most stellar record, and when he was a member of the Texas legislature, I forget whether he was in the House or Senate in the state of Texas. I think he was a congressman in Texas, but I could be wrong.
Make another point.
Sure.
When Johnson started all these programs for minorities, what Nixon did when he came into power, got rid of all these minority programs and to help poor minorities.
Some of them. Reagan did a much better job than Nixon did. Point taken. And the larger point is that whether or not Lyndon Johnson was a racist is almost irrelevant given his behavior. He behaved in a way that helped people of color in the United States. And frankly, I'd say it's because we, the people, got active, and he felt the political pressure at his back, and he had to act. And that's why it's so important that we continue to be active. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Okay, in the ongoing debate about affirmative action and who benefited from it, tip of the hat to Tim at Carnegie. I don't know if Tim wants to be identified, who sent me this link. Thank you. January 20th, 2003, CBS News. It's on the CBS News website, cbsnews.com. You can search for it. The headline is Powell Defends Affirmative Action. And it talks about how Senator Colin Powell is defending affirmative action. And then it cites National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. And quoting from CBS News, quote, and I knew I'd seen or read this someplace, Rice said she had benefited from affirmative action during her career at Stanford University. Quote, I think they saw a person that they thought had potential. And yes, I think they were looking to diversify the faculty, she said. I think there's nothing wrong with that in the United States, Rice said. It does not mean that one has to go to people of lower quality. Race is a factor in our society. End of quote. In a Friday interview with the American Urban Radio Network, Rice said she agreed that affirmative action is needed, quote, if it does not lead to quotas, end quote. So, interesting. John in Seattle, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I was calling about the emails. They were talking about deleting. I was glad to hear that Congress can get their hands on the physical machine, that is, get hold of the hard drive, because even though you delete it, you have to do it seven times before you totally destroy it.
It depends on the hard drive, I think, and it depends on the server, and it depends on whether, you know, what it's been overwritten with and all this kind of thing. But yeah.
You got to do it seven times.
Ah,
there's
interesting.
There's a mil-spec out that says you got to do that.
Okay.
So,
all righty. Well, interesting, John. We'll see how it all shakes out. And by the way, just a little information here. Ellen Ratner just sent me a note. She says the email had to be on a server at some point. That server is most likely backed up by some process. Even if it's only 6 months, the backup should shed some light. If not backed up and the email was deleted, then there might be something left on the hard drive, she says. She also points out a difference between HTTP, IMAP, and POP types of servers. And you know, we won't get into all the elaborate details, but the bottom line is this is going to be very interesting if Congress subpoenas this stuff. Paul in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Paul. Lyndon Johnson was not a liberal. I mean, he was a...
Until he became president.
Yes. Hubert Humphrey was a liberal. I mean, there was a clear divide in the party back then.
Yeah, and absolutely. But once Johnson became president, he began pursuing and following liberal policies. And, and in my opinion, that's not because he was a liberal down all the way down to the bottom of his feet. It's because the political pressure. It was the will of the people, and he got it. And the parade was moving along, and he decided to get out in front of the parade and hoist the flag. Good point, Paul. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Jennifer in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to remind all your listeners about the National Day of Climate Action on Saturday, the Step It Up action. People can go to
StepItUp2008.org, right?
07. Step It Up 07.
2007. Yeah, 2008. That's right. That's the year. Thank you.
StepItUp07.org. And this is a way for people to get active. They can get together with their local climate activists and send a message to Congress about reducing CO2 emissions 80% by 2050.
Right. Okay.
And can you talk to Bernie Sanders about that tomorrow? Because I believe he's going to be speaking at a Step It Up event on Saturday. And he has legislation co-sponsored with Boxer. It used to be Boxer Jeffords that does call for 80% by 2050.
Oh, yeah. He's talked about that every Friday the last couple of weeks. I'm sure he'll bring it up. If he doesn't, I will. And if I don't, feel free to call in. But thank you very much, Jennifer. Paula in Lafayette, Louisiana. Hey, Paula.
Hey there. I know you're talking about voter fraud, but you've also mentioned election fraud, and there's a parish county nearby, and there was an election that was very close, and someone had wanted to bring to the attention that there had been some registration fraud, and one of the things that was brought up was the person had done an absentee voting ahead of time, and somehow saw the list of people's names who had voted, and her name was not on there. And she informed the voter registrar person and was very emphatic about it. So they said, well, okay, you just go ahead and sign this. And they opened the machine that was sealed.
Wow.
And
so that's not voter fraud. That's election fraud. I mean,
election fraud. And she brought this forward, and they said, well, that's not adequate, and she got some more information, and the person she told said that wasn't enough to bring the show election fraud. Also, the voter registrar had personally been told by other people that they were paying people not to go vote at that time also, and that didn't seem to make a difference for election fraud.
Sure, and Yeah, absolutely, Paula. Well said, and thank you very much. And also keep in mind, down in the South, people in largely African-American communities, in minority communities right across the board, but largely in African-American communities, were getting calls and in some cases flyers in the mail saying that if any member of their family had ever been convicted of any crime, or if they had as much as a parking ticket, when they showed up at the polls to vote, they would be arrested. People were also getting calls from the sheriff's department, just checking out voter fraud here. I wanted to make sure that you're actually, you know, these kinds of intimidation techniques, in some cases even going house to house, knocking on doors. And, of course, in the white communities, people were getting these flyers that were saying, you know, they had a picture of the Bible and said, you know, no, this will be illegal if John Kerry is elected. I mean, it was just outrageous, the stuff that the Republicans were doing in the last election. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls as he has for 3.5 years, every Friday at noon here on this program. Dan Goldwater will be with us. He's the chairman of the Legal Arizona Workers Act and son of U.S. Senator Barry Goldwater. He's here on the Arizona law that could stop businesses from hiring illegals. Yes, we have an illegal employer problem in the United States. The best of the news at your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Ted, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.